Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Hi, I'm Chris Farrow for NPR News, and I'm substituting for Carrie Miller. And now I want to shift our discussion to regulation. So conservative legislatures and their allies, they seem poised to be making, the biggest move toward cutting down on regulation since the Reagan administration, or at least since the Reagan administration. And the ambition probably even goes much farther. Let's set a new benchmark. President Trump, he told a meeting of business leaders, quote, "We think we can cut regulations by 75%, maybe more." And he added that regulations are out of control. So liberals and progressives worry about health, energy, safety, environmental regulations are going to be tossed aside. And there's all these questions that are being raised, 75% of what? Total regulations, major rules, outdated rules, over what time period? And what I want to focus on this morning in particular is regulatory reform. I mean, can we really achieve a better balance between encouraging innovation, economic growth, and consumer protection? And we have two wonderful guests to discuss this topic this morning. First is Michael Mandel. He's chief economic strategist at the Progressive Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. He's also co-author of the Progressive Policy Institute's policy memo, Regulatory Improvement Commission. Welcome, Mike.
Good morning, Chris.
And my other guest is Richard Revesz. He is director of the Institute for Policy Integrity at New York University School of Law and environmental law professor at NYU. He is co-author of Struggling for Air, Power Plants, and the War on Coal. So glad you could join us, Richard.
Thank you so much.
So, and of course, we want your calls. So call us with your question or if you have a comment. The number is 651-227-6000. You can call us toll-free at 800-242-2828. And you can go online at nprnews.org/live. And Stephanie Curtis is with me here in the studio, and she will be gathering your questions. So to start off, for both of you, I'd like to get your reaction just to the executive action by President Trump, which was targeted regulatory reform. And it's the it's the requirement that if the Department of Energy, Department of Education, they want to enact a new regulation, they have to get rid of two of them. So one in, two out. And I'll start off with you, Richard. What do you think of the one in, two out policy?
Well, it's a very arbitrary and rational approach to regulation, and it's also coupled with another component, which requires that rules have no net costs on the economy. And the main problem is that this whole approach overlooks all of the benefits of regulation. It pretends that regulations have only costs and no benefits, and it focuses only on the costs. So under this approach, a regulation that cost $100 but had literally tens of billions of dollars of benefits, like some environmental rules do, would not be able to be enacted. And that is irrational.
Mike?
Well, it's interesting because this I think the regulatory structure does need to be reformed, but this particular proposal is laughable. It consists of two parts. One is the part about new regulations. And if Trump just wants to not have new regulations, he can just tell all of his appointees, don't do any new regulations.
Right.
The part about the two old ones, well, you know, every president since Jimmy Carter has passed an executive order or two about retrospective review, telling the agencies to look back and try to clean up old regulations, and they never work. What we need to do is we need to sort of have a process that balances out the benefits of regulation with kind of cleaning away the underbrush, because what's happened is we've had a buildup of regulations that are accumulation that really have effectively blocked a dynamism in the economy. So I think there's work there to be done, but we tend to think of it as regulatory improvement rather than wholesale reduction of regulations.
Okay, so for both of you, you both hit on something that I wanted to bring out, because one of my frustrations is when you think about regulatory reform, and you'd mentioned, Richard, about the costs and the benefits, you seem to look at one set of studies, and this set of studies says, oh, this is so costly, all this regulation. Then you look at another competing set of studies, and they say, no, let's look at the benefits. And then the average person, when they look at the costs, they go, oh, that's terrible. When they look at the benefits, they say, hey, that's kind of a good thing. And at the same time, how are we supposed to think about improving this very system that, I mean, regulations really impact this economy, it impacts how business invests, it impacts the quality of our life as consumers. I mean, Washington and regulation may be, I don't know, the biggest driver, the biggest influence that Washington has on our economy?
I think, Chris, that you're right about that, but I also think that, benefit-cost analysis is kind of misguided. Congress passes regulations because people think that's important. We think that we have important goals. And sort of putting a dollar amount on it is really not all that relevant. The fact is we have environmental regulations because the great majority of American people think that environmental regulations, improving the environment, is important. These things end up getting passed because there's support for them. I do think we want to make sure that if we enact a regulation, that we sort of do it in a way that's the most efficient, and that we don't end up putting too many burdens on business. But I think it's a matter of improvement as opposed to sort of even kind of weighing things against each other.
What do you think?
Well,
Richard?
I have a different perspective. I'm a fan of cost-benefit analysis, and when Congress enacts legislation, it does respond to political pressure to take care of a problem, but Congress doesn't actually solve the problem. It just empowers administrative agencies to promulgate regulations under the statute, and then the agencies do that. Now, in every administration since Ronald Reagan's, agencies have to justify almost all of the regulations on cost-benefit grounds. Ronald Reagan introduced his executive order. Bill Clinton replaced it with his own, but his own was very similar. And the Clinton order essentially has remained in place through the Bush administration and the Obama administration. And that's the bread and butter of how regulatory policy gets done in this country. And I think it's served us well. I think that it has enacted rules that have, in the aggregate, benefits that vastly outweigh the costs. And not to say there can't be improvements. Obviously, there can be. I agree that retrospective review can be a good thing, even though we haven't figured out how to do it well yet. But we should never lose track of the benefits, and I don't think there is any way to do this right without comparing the benefits and the costs.
Okay, so I have a couple of follow-up questions, but I would like to bring Doug in. He's into our conversation. Doug, you're from southern Minnesota?
I'm actually from Minneapolis, traveling down south.
Got it. So what's your comment or question?
Well, I would like to hopefully steer the conversation or have you guys comment on the idea that regulation does not have to come from politicians and their lobbyists who support them. Regulation can come, and it's probably more effective, if it comes from the free market. So, for example, the idea that a company who owns a factory on a river upstream might pollute that river to the regulated allowed amount. And that amount is decided by lobbyists, the company themselves who do the polluting, and the politicians who might gain from the benefits of having a favor for that lobbyist, for that company, instead of allowing individuals to sue the upstream polluters criminally or for causing sickness and harm. And that's something is a stronger regulation, is a better regulation.
Okay.
You know.
So, Richard, this is what do you think?
Yeah, well, plaintiffs can do that now. The problem is that the legal regime puts various roadblocks in their way. They often have trouble showing causation. So, for example, they might be exposed to a product that's a carcinogen, and they might get cancer at some point. but it'll be hard to prove that it was exposure to that carcinogen that caused their cancer as opposed to exposure to other carcinogens to which we are all exposed in our everyday lives. It might take a long time for the cancer to manifest itself. There may be statute of limitations problems. There might be difficulties bringing this litigation because you have to hire a lawyer, and lawyers are expensive, and class actions can ameliorate that, but the class action rules are complicated as well. But the tort system is there as a backdrop, and it exists now. Tort suits are broad, but for many of these widespread environmental problems, they don't give us a solution. If a factory pollutes the air and affects a million people, it might increase the probability that each gets cancer by a little bit, that it'll be difficult for the tort system to compensate individuals for that increase. There'll be these causation problems and statute of limitation problems that I mentioned.
Mike?
It would just be easier for Congress to pass legislation that tightened up the limits.
Right.
I mean, this, I think, is a really excellent example of what I was talking about. You know, what happens is that there's a problem, and then there's a reaction, and you sort of can get a certain amount of public support in sort of tightening up the limits, and you sort of see this as the result of a political process that is a balance between what people want and what they're willing to pay for. And I try very hard not to think of regulation as sort of a result of a technocratic process. I think of it as a result of a political process that sort of reflects what people care about.
So is the issue that you're isolating on, Mike, or one of the issues that you're isolating on, is that there's simply been over the time an accumulation of regulations that, you know, it's like if you have a stream and you keep throwing a pebble into that stream, the first pebble doesn't have any implications, the second pebble doesn't. But by the time you're up to several thousand pebbles, you actually may have a dam.
That's right. I love that. I love that image. Since I came up with it a couple of years ago, everybody sort of uses it. Regulatory accumulation is something that is insidious and quiet, and we don't have any good way of undoing regulations that have sort of piled up. And I think this is one of the main reasons that we've had a slowdown in innovation and growth. And so, you know, what can we do? We can sort of set up a process by which we can sort of pare away some of those pebbles and kind of make it easier to do. And we put forward a process like that called the Regulatory Improvement Commission that got embodied in legislation that was sort of put into the House and Senate with bipartisan sponsors. And who knows what will happen under the current Congress.
So I want to get back to this in a minute, but I also want to go to Stephanie. You have some online?
Yeah, I had a comment from David in Minneapolis. He went to nprnews.org/live, but you can also call 651-227-6000 or call 1-800-242-2828. All right, David says, when I think about regulation, I think about thalidomide and rivers on fire. People aren't thinking about the impact of reducing regulations. We've had chemical plants here explode.
Yeah. So I want both of you to address this, but I'll start off with you, Richard.
Well, that's exactly my point. I agree totally. Regulations have enormous benefits. Our life expectancy is a lot longer than it used to be as a result of many of the environmental and health and safety rules. Cars are safer. Factories pollute less, our rivers and waters are cleaner, and the social benefits of that are enormous. They've been calculated, they're enormous. There's been some costs attached to that as well. I mean, it'd be very strange to imagine that we would achieve this level of benefits with no costs. And in some cases, regulations haven't been targeted as well as they could be. But we can never have an intelligent conversation about this issue without underscoring the enormous benefits that the regulatory state since the New Deal has brought us.
So, Mike, how does your idea of the Regulatory Reform Commission fit into this kind of insight? Because the online commenter, I can't remember his name.
David.
So, I mean, because David makes a good point, and I think this is one of the issues that troubles people when they're talking about regulatory reform.
Well, I think that we sort of have to, if we're paring back regulations, we don't want to pare back the things that have important benefits for safety and health. And I think environment falls into that category. I think that occupational health and safety falls into that category. But if you sort of sit down and you sort of think about it, most of the regulations that we have are not those kind of extreme cases. So we were thinking about a regulatory improvement commission that would take input from ordinary people about what regulations they thought were important, which ones they thought were a problem, and that it would select out 15 or 20 to either repeal or improve and send that through Congress. And the idea basically is that you have a rational process for figuring out what makes sense and what doesn't make sense. Now, what's interesting is that at one extreme, you could impose a zero harm rule on everything that businesses do. And you think about it, that would have actually blocked the invention of the automobile. Okay? And so pretty much everything sort of has downsides to it. So you sort of have to sort of figure out kind of what the right level is. And you want to figure out what kind of regulations you want to sort of impose. And there may be better ones or there may be worse ones. We don't have any way of going back at this point and figuring out how to fix these things.
So, Richard, I'm just curious. I mean, I don't want to put you in an unfair position because I don't know if you looked at this sort of regulatory commission idea, but I'm curious what your reaction is.
Well, I think it's easy to agree with the proposition that if some regulations are giving us lots of costs and few benefits, that we should get rid of them. And there have been efforts to do this for a long time. Actually, President Obama had his own effort of this sort. I think it's difficult to do because when you get past the sort of the generalities, a lot of these regulations actually do have real benefits. And let me point out one thing. I mean, I agree that environmental and health and safety regulations have, on balance, been extremely beneficial. But what's interesting is that they are probably the main target of the Trump administration and of the Republican Congress. I mean, Congress invoked the Congressional Review Act last week to set aside the stream protection rule, which prevents waste from mountaintop mining to end up in streams, enormous environmental and health benefits. And Congress set it aside. So they are, in fact, going after environmental and health and safety regulation at the behest of their supporters. I totally agree that an effort to find regulations that have lots of costs and no benefits would be a beneficial one. I'm skeptical that there are a lot of cost savings there. And I think the way to do it is through retrospective review, which is basically a technique that we understand and that's been around across a number of administrations, and it was further strengthened by the Obama administration. It's hard to do, but it deals with the problem in a sensitive and intelligent way.
Okay, so I want to get back to this idea about retrospective review, Mike. But first, I would like to go to another Michael. This is a Michael from White Bear Lake.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was wondering, I've always wondered if there was a way that we could separate regulations for big multinational corporations and the like from regulations for smaller businesses that couldn't, you know, potentially keep up because of those regulations.
That's an excellent idea. I think that what the problem is that if you impose regulations, very often the compliance costs hit the smaller businesses harder than they hit the bigger businesses because the bigger businesses have a separate compliance cost. And so we've had attempts to sort of exempt smaller businesses from the more onerous regulations, but we've discovered that agencies have a hard time doing that. They have a hard time justifying that. And it's a great idea, but in practice it doesn't work that well.
Stephanie?
Yeah, both Matt and Roger at nprnews.org/live have the same question. They want specific examples of high-impact regulations that are worthy of repeal that have reduced innovation.
Okay, well, I'll toss that one to you, Mike, first.
Yeah, so let's actually look at the FDA, because that's actually sort of an interesting one.
And that's Food and Drug Administration.
Food and Drug Administration. We've spent as a country like $1 trillion on biosciences R&D over the last decade, and it just is very, very hard to get new drugs, new devices through the FDA. And one can sort of argue back and forth about, you know, are the safety requirements too high? Are the efficacy requirements too high? Do they require too many tests? But what happens is that the more tests that they require, yes, it increases the safety, but it also increases the cost of the drug or the device to consumers. So at some point, we have to kind of decide where we want to draw that line, because we need things that are going to reduce the cost of healthcare. We need to do things in a way that help people live longer without actually imposing more costs. And there's something about the way we're handling regulation, the FDA, that is not quite right at this point.
Richard, any thoughts about, you know, dealing with the FDA? Because this conversation keeps coming up a lot, and I think it makes people a little bit. It's one of these classic examples where, yes, we want stuff to be approved faster, but then you read about, I mean, this is an ancient example, but probably the classic example, formaldehyde, or, you know, some of these other examples that are out there. So the FDA.
Well, I think the FDA is like every other agency. I mean, we should be looking at their rules, and if there are rules that have high costs and comparatively small benefits, or if there are ways of changing the rules so that we get the bulk of the benefits but can get rid of the bulk of the cost, that would be a good thing. And retrospective review lets us get there. I don't think any agency has a monopoly on this problem. They are all trying to produce benefits. They all have some costs attached to them. Sometimes we might be able to fine-tune regulations to get the benefit of the benefits at lower costs. And when those possibilities are there, we should be trying to do them.
Can I add one more thing on the FDA? Which is, the FDA basically follows a principle that says that they're not going to approve a new drug or device unless it's at least as good or better than what's on the market.
That's right.
And that sounds really rational. But the problem is that stops completely any sort of disruptive innovation that maybe gives you, say, 90% of what an existing treatment does at half the price or a quarter of the price. The FDA has no way of approving that. And so at this point now, what happens is the whole, it isn't simply a rule, it's the whole way that the FDA works ends up driving up costs. I mean, what I usually say is that the FDA had been in charge of cell phones in the 1980s. They would have refused to approve them unless the quality of cell phones was at least as good as the quality of landlines. And if you remember those commercials, can you hear me? Okay, we would have ended up with phones that, you know, cost $500 or $1,000 and were big, bulky boxes. And it would have stifled innovation in its tracks. And so I think in some sense the FDA at this point, we have a senior fellow at the Progressive Policy Institute called Joe Gulfo, who's written a lot about different ways that you can deal with efficacy, deal with the approval process that doesn't reduce safety, okay, but may actually have the effect of making the whole process of drug approval less costly. And interestingly enough, weirdly enough, he's actually on the short list for FDA head around. We don't know how this happened, but he's maybe a mark of sanity here.
I'm not so sure that was a ringing endorsement or not, but let's go to a call from Todd from Ramsey. Todd?
Good morning.
Yeah.
My feeling on the topic is that no business is going to be pleased with regulation. They'll always see regulations as detrimental to them and do everything they can to cut back on regulations due to costs. And what I think in particular of is that for so many years, the old line energy industries had regulations, coal plants in particular. But as soon as they became strength and expansion of the solar industry, who was it that called out for restrictions on the solar industry as to placement of the grids, as to attaching your home solar system to the power lines? It was the old line industries. So right. They're willing to have regulations to help them. But, of course, any regulation that may go the other direction, they'll fight against tooth and nail.
Richard?
Yes. So this connects very nicely with the FDA example.
Yeah.
So in the current political debate, this is often these issues are often presented as there are these like liberals want regulation and they're stifling industry and industry opposes regulation. But these kinds of bad regulations we've been talking about are there at the behest of industry. Existing actors in the FDA regulatory scheme want to keep new actors out of the way. And so they lobby the agency, and in many cases they capture the agencies in order to keep new entrants out of the way. The example of fossil fuels trying to keep renewables out is exactly the same problem. So you know, what this underscores is that this is not some sort of titanic struggle between progressives and big business where progressives are trying to destroy big business. A lot of these bad regulations are anti-competitive rules that come because entrenched business wants to keep competitors out of their markets.
Mike?
And that's precisely right, and that's why it's important to sort of undo as many of these as possible. Okay, he's put his finger on the reason why a separate regulatory improvement commission is necessary is because, in fact, big businesses have accommodated themselves to these existing regulations. They're not going to be a force getting rid of them. We have to have a separate force that has the mandate to cut things back in order to provide more room for new entrants to come in.
Well, so, we agree on this part, but this deals with only a very small chunk of the problem. We're regulating, for example, the mercury emissions of power plants. We're not doing it at the behest of powerful, entrenched, and existing firms. We're doing it to protect the consumer. So we shouldn't take this problem, which is a real one, and then build it into a more general argument against regulation. That would be extremely unfortunate.
Okay, now I want to get Meg to come into our conversation. And Meg, what's your question?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I'm most familiar with the administrative rulemaking process, and my question takes us a little bit back to the mechanics of this. And in rulemaking, it's an iterative process in which the public has multiple opportunities to comment as rules are developed. And I'm wondering if the same is true for rule deconstruction.
The answer is, weirdly enough, that to deconstruct rules requires the same process as putting them in place, but there's even more expensive because you actually have to get real data. So, for example, part of the reason why retrospective review doesn't work, and part of the reason why we've suggested a separate commission, in order to sort of undo a rule through the normal process, you have to have hearings, you have to collect information, you have to have real studies, and what happens is it becomes a very expensive and lengthy process. So we're proposing the commission as a way of short-circuiting this, making sure that you can actually pluck out the ones that maybe big business would like not want you to change, and kind of get the economy moving a bit more.
So, Richard, is there a way of thinking about this retrospective review, which you suggested, is there a way of making that more efficient when, to Meg's question about getting rid of regulations?
Yes, there is. And I think one of the reasons the retrospective review has not been successful is because the agency hasn't planned for it at the time that it put a rule in place. So it hasn't collected the data. It hasn't set up the rule in the way that would give it information about the costs and benefits. So we have a proposal, I mean, the institute I run, to basically have every rule, when it's adopted, be coupled with a protocol for performing the prospective review in the future. So the data is collected along the way, and so the agency, at the time the retrospective review is done, is in a good position to do it. And that's not been done before. I think it's a good innovation for the administrative process, and it's one that we ought to do and that could be done.
Well, clearly there's a lot of interest in regulation. But Stephanie, because we're getting a lot of people calling in, but Stephanie, what, you have some online?
Yeah, Jennifer in Cannon Falls has something that's really similar to what we were just talking about. She wants to know, can agencies in this retrospective review just get rid of regulations and add them without congressional support? How do the check and balance system work here?
Well, agencies can repeal rules, but they have to do it through the same process that led to the enactment, the promulgation of the rule, which typically involves notice and comment rulemaking. They have to publish a proposed rule. They have to take comments. Then they respond to comments. Then they publish a final rule. And then the final rule is subject to litigation. So if an agency tries to repeal a rule, opponents of the repeal can sue, and then a court decides whether the repeal was lawful or not.
Mike?
If Congress tells an agency to do something, the agency has to do it. So the agency doesn't have the choice of overriding congressional laws, and that turns out to be a really big problem. It's a mistake to think about, you know, that the agencies are doing this of their own accord. Congress tells them what to do. Within that framework, they come up with rules. If they didn't do those rules, people would have the right to sue them. And so this is, you know, this interaction between Congress and the agencies, the executive branch, is just really interesting. And in some sense, it's a problem that we haven't solved, Europe hasn't solved, Japan hasn't solved. How to make our regulatory system more nimble. And, you know, Chris, part of the reason why we're getting so much interest is that this is not an abstract matter for people.
No, this affects people's lives. Yeah.
People deal with regulations, you know, every day. And it's not just on the federal level. It's on the state and local level. And I have to say, one of the biggest failures of our current economy is that we need regulations to function, but we sort of haven't figured out how to stop them from becoming a straitjacket around us, for sort of tying us down. And this is a problem that democratic societies have to solve. And part of the reason, I mean, I have to say, part of the reason for why people elected Trump is they elected him to try to cut through the regulation. They understand that the regulation is doing great things, that there's a lot of benefits, but they sort of feel it constricting around them.
So before I let the two of you go, Richard, I'll start with you. I mean, what do you want people to take away as they think about regulations? Like, we just got an email here. Someone, the Sierra Club, has just emailed them that, you know, looking at fracking and drilling for oil in 40 national parks, and this is what the administration would like to do. And, you know, how do you fight this dismantling of regulations? So in the environment we're in, what do you want people to take away about thinking about improving the regulatory structure?
Well, I want them to think about the benefits and the costs. I don't want them to think just about the benefits. I don't want them to think just about the costs. And I want them to think about how we can structure the regulation so that we maximize the net benefits, the difference between benefits and costs. And there are design issues that we can deal with that will make that more likely. I think this is all a balance, and that's what we should focus on.
Michael?
Yeah, so we at the Progressive Policy Institute are basically pro-growth progressives. We believe that regulation is important, and we sort of, and you need to do it right. But on a larger philosophical level, this is how we do regulation in a way that works for people is going to be a bigger and bigger issue. It's not going to go away, and we can't deal with it with technocratic fixes.
And then, so Michael, one of the things that I've noticed with the, you know, when they ask for comments about regulation, that a lot of large businesses, they have regulatory compliance departments. I mean, they have a real stake in there. How does the average citizen get a voice?
Hey, that's a great question. You know, there is no place in the government, okay, for the average citizen to complain about regulations. The first thing that any government can do is identify a central place where ordinary citizens and small businesses can complain about regulations, where that is collected and taken seriously. And right now, in most governments, most levels of government, that doesn't exist.
Richard, what do you think? I mean, what about the citizens having a voice, and particularly in the areas that you specialize in? I mean,
right,
the environment. And that's where, you know, like this question that we just got about the national parks. I mean, that's where a lot of people really want to focus
right
on.
Citizens have a voice. Whether they're with an effective voice or not is a different issue. For example, when EPA was considering the Clean Power Plan, the regulation that limits the greenhouse gas emissions of power plants, it received 4 million comments, and the vast majority of those were from citizens, most of them supporting the rule. I'm sure that the fact that there were 4 million comments with the bulk of them supporting the rule played a role in the way the administration considered the issue. Then there are also technocratic groups that represent people who have various interests. There were the major environmental organizations commented and presented very high-quality comments that were a foil to the comments presented by industry groups. So the notice and comment rulemaking process works reasonably well. I think the arguments on both sides tend to be presented effectively by sophisticated. And the citizens can actually send their views as part of the public comment process.
Well, we could go on. As I said, we have some more calls, people on the line, but I have to cut it short at this point, and I really want to thank both of you. Michael Mandel is Chief Economic Strategist at the Progressive Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and Richard Revesz is Director of the Institute for Policy Integrity at New York University School of Law.